For the week of December 26, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 85, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in San Francisco, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
I traveled for once, right?
Yes.
For once, I'm somewhere other than Los Angeles.
What are you doing there?
Seeing my mom. It has nothing to do with work or anything exciting other than the holidays.
Well, now, speaking of work, you have an announcement to make.
I have an announcement. I was going to say it's a good segue, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This podcast will be my last.
No.
I know. I just, you know, I found that my social media career is taking up much more of my life than my entertainment portion of my life. So it makes more sense for me to just focus on that. You guys need to find somebody whose entire life is entertainment. It's not, unfortunately, not quite my entire life anymore.
Well, right. But I mean, the good news for you is that you've got a ton of clients now because, of course, the podcast helped bring in all of those clients.
Sure.
And
It did. But yeah, I mean, that portion of my life is just starting to take up a lot more time.
That's good news in a way.
It's great news. It's really great news. But I will definitely miss you guys.
Well,
and the great news for me is that my career is so stagnating that I can devote plenty of time to the podcast for years to come.
Oh, irony.
I'll come back whenever you guys want me to. I'll be a guest.
We're going to miss you, and we have no plans to replace her, because who could replace Karen? We'll just keep going on with the show, and if someday we find a guest and they seem like a great fit, just like I guess I turned out for you guys early on in the show's run, because I was just a guest on one of your early shows, then
yeah,
maybe we'll consider
an obvious fit.
Yeah, we'll consider that down the road, but for now, we just can't even think of replacing. We'll just leave an empty chair there for Karen as tribute.
Well, speaking of news, on today's show, we will be wrapping up the year.
That's enough sentimentality, Karen.
Yeah, the end.
Well, I mean, you know.
No, believe me, I tease, and yet I don't tease. That's quite enough.
You know, our listeners are, they're trying to keep it under an hour. On today's show, we'll be wrapping up the year by reviewing some of the more popular films, at least in terms of grosses and piracy. And speaking of piracy, you may remember independent film producer Cotty Chubb from episode 59. His film Unthinkable was leaked onto the internet weeks before its release. We're going to check back in with him to see if the rave reviews that the pirated version received helped the film financially. Chubb will also be joining us to discuss how Relativity topper Ryan Kavanaugh can save the movies. Of course, we'll cover all the big showbiz news stories during Big Deal or Big Whoop, which I guess we're going to have to somehow rephrased to Big Deal or eh. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the number one movie of the weekend is a film I'd like to make my mother say the title of. It's Little Fockers. It grossed $34 million over the weekend, $48 million since its release 5 days ago. Number two is True Grit, the Coen Brothers Western, which is, I think, the highest grossing opening weekend for any Western ever. At $25.6 million, it's grossed $36 million total. It's certain to be one of their biggest hits of all time, if not their biggest hit. At number three is Tron Legacy, the reboot of the film from the early 80s. It grossed $20 million over the weekend, $88 million total, but it's falling pretty hard and pretty fast, and word of mouth is terrible. The same is true for The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which seems to have put the nail in the coffin of the Narnia series. It has grossed $10.8 million, $63 million total in the U.S. for a movie that cost $155 million to make. And number five is Yogi Bear, which grossed $8.8 million and is at $36 million total. Number six is The Fighter, the expanding art house film starring Mark Wahlberg that grossed $8.5 million and $27 million total. And number seven, the biggest flop of the week, if not the month or the year, Gulliver's Travels, which grossed $7.2 million, a dreadful, dreadful opening weekend for the Jack Black comedy. And number eight is Black Swan, another indie film that's platforming very nicely. It grossed $6.6 million and $29 million total. And number nine, the Disney animated film Tangled, grossed another $6.5 million, $143 million in the U.S., and $260 million total worldwide so far. At number 10 is The Tourist, the Angelina Jolie, Johnny Depp flop, which grossed $5.7 million. That's a $41 million total. And at number 11, this movie I went to see on Sunday with my family, The King's Speech, which grossed $4.5 million as it starts to platform out around the country. And it's at $8.4 million total, and it's only just begun. I'm certain of that. So I saw The King's Speech. My family loved it. Everyone from a college student to my mother. This is a real crowd pleaser. I think it's going to do great for months to come. What about you guys? Did you see any movies this weekend?
I saw Black Swan.
Oh, what'd you think?
I'm not sure. I'm still wrapping my brain around it. I didn't hate it, but I can't say I loved it. I wasn't bored, but I can't say I think it's a phenomenal movie. I don't know.
I'm with you. It was sort of silly, but well made.
It had, yeah, and it had moments where you're like, oh, come on. But they were fewer than the good moments in it. And the performances are fantastic.
You didn't go with your mom, did you?
No.
Oh, good, good.
Definitely not one you see with your mother.
I'd send her to get popcorn during the lesbian makeout scene.
Which wasn't anywhere near as racy as we were led to believe. I was like, that's it?
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Sperling?
I saw a film with good performances as well. I saw True Grit, which the Coen brothers made, their biggest opening for a Coen brothers film and the biggest opening for a Western for some time. And it was a great movie. I really enjoyed it. Have you seen this movie, Michael?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's a really good film and fantastic performances. Jeff Bridges, if I were Paramount, I'd be pushing him for Best Supporting Actor rather than Best Actor because he has a better shot at Best Supporting Actor. It's really a well-done film, great acting, great writing, and of course the story is legendary.
Yeah, no, it's a great novel by Charles Portis, and the novel is terrific, and it's all told from the point of view of this little girl. And the original film starring John Wayne had the 14-year-old girl played by a 22-year-old woman. They just made her an adult, and it was really all about John Wayne's character. So it threw the whole story out of whack. So this remake has a lot of point to it. There's a lot of reason to do this remake. And the young girl in that role is terrific. And it sort of peters out. Like,
what is her name? Haley Steinfeld?
Yeah,
she's supposed to be amazing.
Yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, I mean, who knows how she'll transition as an adult, but she's certainly one of those very self-confident child actors that you can imagine making it as an adult. And she's really good. She'll probably be up for an award. Bizarrely, like you say, she should be up for lead actress and they'll push her for supporting actress. And Jeff Bridges should be up for supporting actor, but they'll probably try and make him best actor. So it's one of those crazy Oscar things.
Well, I also saw another film with great performances, or at least one, Emma Stone.
Easy A.
Easy A.
I can't wait to see that movie. It's at the top of my Netflix queue.
Yeah, it's good, actually. Have you seen it, Michael?
It's good. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's like the great high school comedy of the, you know, it's not like Dazed and Confused or Clueless, but it's a solid, good, fun, entertaining comedy.
Yeah. And what I agree with you, it's not as good as Dazed and Confused or even Mean Girls, but it's a solid, endearing movie. And quite honestly, I was a little disappointed that they relied so heavily on past teen comedies and past teen movies for their own content, but still well worth seeing if only for Emma Stone.
Yeah, she's terrific. She's definitely a rising star. And that was definitely one of the indie word of mouth hits of the year. It's not an indie film, I shouldn't say that, but it's certainly one of the smaller word of mouth hits. It did very well at the box office and is doing well on DVD. But the top grossing movie in the US for the entire year was an animated film, Toy Story 3, which grossed $415 million in the US and $1 billion worldwide. That's just one of the 10 top grossing movies that was released in the US in 2010.
And I guess another animated movie came in number two, Alice in Wonderland.
It's not animated. It's live action. It stars Johnny Depp, and it grossed $1 billion worldwide and $334 million in the U.S. Iron Man 2 was number three at $312 million. The Twilight Saga Eclipse, then Inception, Harry Potter, Despicable Me, Shrek Forever After, How to Train Your Dragon, and The Karate Kid. I have seen all of those except for Iron Man 2.
Well, you didn't get my joke there that Alice in Wonderland was animated.
I corrected it. Why is it a joke?
Well, because of all of the CGI, of course.
Oh, well, you know, it's true. Digital effects and all that stuff.
Whenever you tell a joke, Sperling, you've got to say something like, okay, wink, wink, because we don't always hear it in your voice.
Yeah, I'm going to need, you know, I need like a laugh track or something.
Well, yeah, so it's a year of a very typical Hollywood year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sequels, 1, 2, 3, 4 animated films. Only two of the movies are original, not based on some other property, Inception and Despicable Me in the top 10. Well, everything else is based on a book or another movie, or it's a remake or it's a sequel.
And for an original idea, Inception making $825 million worldwide, that's pretty good.
Absolutely. And of course, that starred Leonardo DiCaprio, who, according to Forbes magazine, is 2010's top grossing actor because he had both Inception and Shutter Island, which together grossed $1.1 billion worldwide in 2010. But I think they're wrong right at number two. They claim the number two top grossing actor of the year is Mia Wasikowska. I guess that's because
that's weird, right?
Well, they're saying she's in Alice in Wonderland, and they must be saying only leads count. But really, Johnny Depp sold Alice in Wonderland. He has a major role, and he's clearly right up there with Alice in Wonderland, and even The Tourist would bump him up past her.
Actually, but I guess the reason that Mia Wasikowska came in number two is not only for Alice in Wonderland, but also The Kids Are All Right, which she has a small role in.
Right, but again, Johnny Depp's The Tourist has already grossed more than that, so he still has more money than her.
Yeah, there's no way that The Kids Are All Right made a ton of money.
Yeah, well, yeah, it made like $25 million or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, that would be sort of inconsequential in terms of some – I mean, even the Tourist is going to eventually make more money than that.
It has already, but they're but I guess they're saying she's the lead. I guess they're only counting lead actors. But again,
she
I'd say –
She wasn't the lead in The Kids Are All Right.
Right, then you wouldn't count that. Again, yeah.
By the way, have we talked about the fact that that movie is on all the year's best lists and it's really not that good a movie?
Alice? Oh, The Kids Are All Right. I know. Yeah. It's depressing.
Yeah, what the hell?
I think it's one of those movies where, like, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. I think a lot of people walked out of that movie going, in 1989 when it was, you know, Steven Soderbergh originally made it, I think people walked out going, what the heck was that all about? And yet it made everybody's top 10 lists. I haven't seen it in 20-some-odd years, but I think The Kids Are All Right is the same kind of movie where you're not hip if you don't like it.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
But it's trite. It's really just a trite sort of piece of...
Sex, Lies, and Videotape is a masterpiece. It's such a great film. But regardless of how good or bad you think it is, it's a very, you know, mature adult art film. Kids Are All Right is a sitcom. They're not even remotely alike.
Yeah, it's a silly, silly movie. Have you seen it, Sperling?
I have, twice, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's silly.
Did you like, is it on your best of the year list?
No.
No. But you don't like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, huh?
No, I'm not saying that, but I think a lot of people when they first saw it, at least people who were my age in their early 20s when they first saw it, were kind of a little confused by it. People in their 30s loved it, like late 20s, early 30s, they loved it. And they found it really compelling. But I think people my age at the time were a little confused by what was so great about it. But they had to say it was fantastic because if they didn't, then they weren't real, you know.
But I don't think there's any hip factor associated with The Kids Are All Right. I don't think anybody.
Well, there was when it first came out because of the fact that it was a lesbian marriage that was treated for the most part like any other marriage.
But Modern Family's on TV. It's just an old hat.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm like, the movie was ridiculous.
Why didn't more people pirate it? That's what I want to know.
Segway.
Wow. That was just such a hard segue. It was like a battering ram of a segue. But that's okay, because we do have to talk about film piracy. And what film do you think was the number one? Well, you're probably reading the show notes, so I don't know why I'm asking this.
But I did, but I can't remember, so surprise me.
Number one pirated movie of 2010.
Avatar.
Yes.
Yes. Well, of course, that's the top grossing.
I swear to God, I didn't cheat.
Well done. But that's also the top grossing movie of 2010. It's not on a list because it was officially released in 2009. But it grossed more than, in the U.S., it grossed more than Toy Story 3. So that's just how these things work.
And yet it was pirated 16.58 million times.
And Toy Story 3 is not on this list at all. Can you explain that, Sperling?
I can't explain that at all. I have no idea why that is. Torrent Freak is the source for all of these numbers. Kick-Ass was the number two pirated movie at 11.4 million downloads. Inception, number three with 9.7. Shutter Island, number four, 9.4. So what I find interesting is all of these films that have been pirated, or at least most of them, everybody's saying, oh, piracy is really making a huge dent into the box office. And yet there's only really three films that are listed here that did well, you know, as far as downloads are concerned, but didn't do well theatrically, and that's Kick-Ass at number two, Green Zone at number seven, and The Hurt Locker at number nine.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, Hurt Locker did well compared to its budget, but it certainly would have benefited from a lot more of paying customers that they lost, and Kick-Ass is the clear loser here since that was a film that deserved a lot more box office than it got, and clearly people liked it if they downloaded it more than any other movie
but
this
it's
year.
It's also the type of movie that really appeals to
downloaders.
Download things, yeah.
I wonder if Toy Story 3 isn't on this list because the people who would be downloading it actually wanted to go see it in the theater. Whereas maybe with Clash of the Titans, which is at number six.
Avatar.
And Iron Man 2. Well, maybe these are people that are just...
Inception, Avatar. These are all movies.
I think Sperling is an interesting point. Also, a lot of people who watch Toy Story are watching it with their kids. And it's like, hey, honey, let me teach you how to download a movie illegally.
I teach my kids how to download movies illegally.
Yeah, but you're you.
No, I don't do that. So please, no emails.
FBI is calling.
Well, either way, this piracy list from Torrent Freak represents a 33% increase in download activity from last year's top pirated film, Star Trek, which was downloaded 11 million times.
Well, we would expect this sort of thing to only increase as the years go on.
There's this argument being made that, 3D films, combat piracy, but apparently not, because you got Avatar on there. You have Clash of the Titans. So I don't necessarily see that as being a deterrent to piracy.
Right, a popular movie people want to see. And most of the time, if they're going to go see Avatar or Clash of the Titans at home, they're probably going to watch it in 2D anyway. So there's no loss for them. If they're going to watch it at home, 2D is what they're going to see it in probably.
Well, we'll be talking a little bit more about 3D in the home a little bit later on, but right now we should bring in Connie Chubb in a guest post on IndieWire's Thompson on Hollywood blog. Indie producer Connie Chubb put forth a modest proposal for Relativity chief Ryan Kavanaugh that he believes could save the movies. Now, you might remember Connie Chubb from episode 59, where we talked to him about his film Unthinkable, which is a great film and I believe is available on Amazon and Netflix and pretty much everywhere, but it was pirated a few weeks before its theatrical release and its release on DVD. And Cotty, thank you for joining us. We should probably get a quick update on how Unthinkable is doing.
Okay, just briefly, there was actually no theatrical release because we lost the P&A funds. So it was only coming out on video. And about 4 weeks before it was released, the Blu-ray rip hit the web, and it became very, very gratifyingly popular. Hit number three on the IMDb, movie meter with no marketing and no anything except word of mouth from people who were stealing it. And they really liked it a lot. So that was nice. In talking with Steve Birch at Sony about it, he basically said it performed all right. You know, the DVD market is down substantially. I think two, three years ago, they would have thought it would have done, maybe $8 million in business in DVDs. And these days, I think he's looking at $4.5 million. But that seems to be about what... That reflects more, I think, the change in the DVD market than it does an effect of all of the theft of intellectual property. And I think it's very unclear whether all of that, theft of intellectual property, as it's called, actually had a bad effect. It may indeed have, given this unique and specific circumstances of this particular this particular movie, which had no real marketing and certainly had no theatrical marketing at all. It's pretty unclear whether all of that was good or bad for the movie. I don't think we can say.
Well, there was also a lot of debate on your post on Ann Thompson's blog, Thompson on Hollywood, which is over at IndieWire, about how Ryan Kavanaugh can save the movies. And you kind of talk about theatrical marketing and theatrical word of mouth helping video on demand and DVD sales.
The problem that I see, there's a couple of problems. One is that, this is a terrible year for the movie business, although in that the admissions have dropped substantially. They've dropped 4 or 5%. And over 10 years, since 2000, in fact, ticket sales have not gone up at all. So in a time when, as we know from the census reports, the population grew by 10%, ticket sales didn't grow. The only growth comes from raising prices. Prices went up on average 5% last year. In the year of the worst depression in 70 years, they raised their ticket prices 5%. And not surprisingly, ticket sales went down. And I'm very worried about that as a producer and as somebody who looks at the movie business and loves the movie business, because if our audience is evaporating, it's not good for the long-term growth of the business. The particular issue that I have is that fastest declining market segment is 18 to 25 year olds. And they're still a really big segment of the market, but they are the fastest declining. It is as though our future ticket buyers are getting out of the habit of going to the movies. They are very price sensitive. I've, for whatever reason, found myself in front of a bunch of classes and students since the Toronto Film Festival, since September. They're saying they're not going to the movies as much because they're too expensive and because they're not getting what they want to see. And I think that that's very dangerous for the business. So my proposal, modest as it was, and to Mr. Kavanaugh, it was aimed at him for a particular reason, because not only has he turned himself into and turned Relativity Media into a powerful player as a producer and now as a distributor, but also he owns Rogue. He bought Rogue from Universal as a young person's movie label, so to speak. And I think he has other big plans for it, for other kinds of branding. But it struck me that he might be the only person in the business who has the strength to be able to say to the exhibitors, you know, three exhibition companies control 50% of the screens in America. That's all.
And that's AMC, Regal Entertainment, and Cinemark.
Yeah. And they hate the idea of day and date release. But for independent films and for films addressed to a younger audience, it makes a lot of sense it seems to me that the essence of a popular movie, what I learned from the Unthinkable experience and from being on the blogs, being on the message boards and being on the and talking to these students, is that you need ubiquity. The picture has to come out whenever, wherever, and however the audience wants to see it, and all at the same time. And that's anathema to exhibitors. So what I proposed was that he make the deal for Rogue Pictures that come out in, you know, less than 300 or 400 screens, a movie like Catfish or other, you know, more particularly targeted movies that don't necessarily have a mass audience, but that might be exciting or innovative or interesting or invigorating for a younger audience, that he say to the exhibitors, hey, just give us a dollar or two from your ticket price. Price it however you want. You want to charge $8 for it? You want to charge $6? I don't really care. Whatever fills your theaters with audiences who are going to buy your popcorn and buy your drinks and, you know, do all of that stuff, which are pure profit centers for exhibitors, whatever fills your theaters is fine with me. Just give me a buck or two for the ticket, but let me have the picture go out at the same time, VOD, on demand, iTunes, Amazon, however you want, however the audience wants it, priced at the price that they want to pay. Because the stranglehold the exhibitors have on the business right now is what is, I think, responsible for the lack of experimentation, the lack of excitement, because kids aren't seeing movies that are made by and for kids. They're just seeing giant product. Even a movie, I'm sorry, I'm just rambling here, but even a movie is like, which I like, a movie like Easy A, that costs $50 million to bring to market between production price and between production costs and marketing costs. And I just think that there's a better chance to invigorate a younger audience, which is the audience of the future. If they get out of the habit of going to the movies, we're screwed. So what can you do to invigorate their movie going appetite? They're not used to seeing, they're used to seeing spectacle. They're not used to seeing anything meaningful, anything emotional, anything that they can see their own lives depicted. Happens sometimes, but rarely. So this was a proposal to say, let's change the economics of theatrical releasing by giving the exhibitors an incentive to allow day and date all platform release.
So we see this happening in independent films, obviously. We see IFC and Sundance doing this, where they'll put a movie out on video on demand 2 weeks or a month before it premieres theatrically, or they'll show something on their TV channel like Carlos, and then they'll put it in their theaters,
sure,
and then they'll also have it on video demand. So we're seeing this sort of experimentation happening. And
but
of course,
but it's happening for older audiences, and they're playing in theaters that are not audiences that young, they're not theaters that young audiences go to. They're not the multiplexes. They're not in the AMCs.
Right. So you're saying they're somewhat pigeonholed or kind of cast aside into theaters that aren't accessible necessarily.
Yeah, they're just not where, there's not where that audience goes to. That audience will, there are a few landmark theaters that I guess will attract a younger audience, but for the most part out in the mass of the country, that's not true in Cincinnati or wherever. You know, it's going to be the AMC or Cinemark or Regal is going to run those theaters, and they won't let that happen.
Well, I don't think it's just the big three. As somebody who kind of works in that space, I can tell you that almost every theater owner, no matter how big or small, is kind of against day and date releasing, because they look at that window as theirs. And of course, they would turn around and say, well, it's not us that's holding everything up. It's, you know, we're reliant on the distributors. So,
I don't understand what that means. I agree with you that they're resistant to day and date, but I don't understand what you mean when you say they're reliant on distributors. What are you talking about?
For product. They are dependent on a distributor giving them product. So they don't necessarily see as being in the driver's seat on this issue. They look at distributors as being in the driver's seat.
But it does, but distributor, you, I cannot, there is no business model for me to make a picture that plays in the AMC theaters that where I'm spending less than $8, $10, $12, $15 million minimum to market it theatrically. It does, there, that business model doesn't exist. Believe me, I've tried raising money on it. It doesn't exist.
It's just sort of like putting a show on a major network versus a cable channel. If you're going to put a show on a major network, you're investing tens of millions of dollars in marketing and creating the show.
Whereas if you put a show on, let's say I make the 2011 equivalent of Raising Arizona. Nick Cage and Holly Hunter weren't big stars. They were crazy young, interesting filmmakers who'd made Blood Simple. You know, you couldn't make that movie today. That it just wouldn't be made. Who would make it? How would it be distributed? You're not going to spend $35 million like they spent on Easy A bringing that picture to market. It's not, it's a comedy, but it's not, you know, what is it?
It's a teen dramedy.
And they don't make that movie anymore.
Right.
In a way, that's an experimental movie, right? It doesn't have a huge high concept. They're not giant stars. It's not pre-sold. It's not branded. It's not product of that sort. It's just these exciting filmmakers who can excite audiences.
So what's the feedback been like from the post that you did?
Of the comments were, then there's this guy. I didn't think many of the comments were really being responsive to what I was trying to say.
Well, some of them were that variable pricing would kind of create confusion so that when you show up at the movie theater.
Oh, sorry. Can I say? Yeah.
Sure.
There's no standards and practices here, I guess.
No.
That's nonsense because you have variable pricing already for 3D.
And for matinees and for Tuesday night shows. I mean, all over the country you have matinee shows and Tuesday night shows.
You know, it just, how many times have I talked to kids who are in their 20s who say, well, I'll go to see Inception because that's worth $30 for me to go with my girlfriend before I eat anything. But I won't go to see something that's like, well, I don't know. It doesn't, you know, they didn't spend $150 million making it. It doesn't have spectacle. I heard this from, you know, the classes at NYU of people who are in the, they want to be in the movie business. God love them. I have no idea why they think that's going to work for them. But they're not going to movies. They themselves are saying.
Well, somebody else said, bring back dollar days and midnight movies, lowering the cost to see movies during the week and making it more expensive to see movies.
It's partly about the pricing, but it's really about making it possible to make movies that have an emotional content. What was the last movie that really mattered emotionally to 23-year-old guys, 18 to 25? Would it be Superbad? And before that, what, Fight Club, which was 15 years ago? I mean, they're not seeing their lives treated fictionally in ways that are stories that make emotional sense. They're seeing Iron Man.
I was going to say, so it isn't Iron Man then. So that's
I liked Iron Man, most of it. By the end of the, by the time I got to the third act, when it was like, well, will the red pixels beat the blue pixels? I didn't care so much. But in terms of actual movies, those are spectacles and branded entertainment. That's a distinction that needs to be made. It's confusing because they take place in the same theater and they're projected in the same way. But you feel differently when you leave a movie than you do when you leave a piece of branded entertainment. And I'm talking about movies, whether it's Say Anything or, I mean, even Easy A kind of reached for it, you know?
Well, my best movie of last year was 500 Days of Summer. That certainly spoke to young people.
Yeah, I think it actually spoke to, I think it spoke to late 20-year-olds. But yeah, I loved it for that. But again, 500 Days of Summer cost the same to go to see as Inception. And that just seems crazy to me.
Most CDs cost $15. Why is that crazy? Most TV shows, you just get them for, I mean.
You get them for free.
Yeah, if you start charging us on a sliding scale for the cost of the movie budget, we'll be paying $80 to see Avatar 2.
But
for other reasons.
But I think the numbers are clear. That audience segment is declining. Movie going is declining, but the ticket sales are declining. The price is rising. Why would we say that a movie audience or segments of the movie audience are not price sensitive? They're price sensitive in every other thing. Why are somehow movie tickets not price sensitive? Doesn't make sense.
Would you say also that it's not only price, but there's also other things that are attracting their attention? There's the internet, there's video games.
Black Ops, what a Code of Honor Black Ops. $360 million the first day it went on sale. They use it, they play it, and then they can sell it back to GameStop and get a chunk of that $60 back. But they get hundreds of hours of gameplay out of it because it matters to them.
Right. Now, Michael R. Bernard, who is a motion picture marketing executive in part, he does other things as well.
I like Michael.
He actually said something that I think most people in marketing would agree with, which is the second you start dropping your prices for one product over another, you're kind of saying that product is worth less. So instead of dropping the price and making it variable pricing, hey, keep everything the same price, but have the filmmakers offer a coupon to go see the movie in a theater, be it AMC or an art house. To get the coupon, of course, you're building your community and you have to provide your email address.
Jonathan Dana wrote about that too. He also, in the comment section, Jonathan, who knows a good deal about movie marketing himself, looked at the Groupon model, and which is, again, a very good sign of price sensitivity. He looked at the Groupon model as a way to try to encourage movie going at a reduced price. The real thing I was trying to do was to say, let the local theater owners determine whatever the pricing is that will fill their theaters and give them lots of people who will buy their popcorn. Let them price for maximum attendance, give the distributor, in this case Rogue, a lesser cut of theatrical, and allow Rogue then to concentrate all of its marketing on getting the movie out on any platform at any time at any price, because that's what the Unthinkable experience showed me. Those people knew that they were getting something for nothing. They knew they were, quote, stealing. Many of them did. But they said, I want to see the movie. My friend said it was great. And here's how I can.
But do you think that Rogue should be, or any distributor should then be, sharing the VOD or DVD or any revenue from non-theatrical revenue with theaters?
No, I think it makes perfect sense to say, this is your area. Price it the way you want. I'll take less from you if you allow me to make it more accessible to the audience the way the audience wants to get it.
So in other words, as a theater, you'll be getting your product effectively for free.
Well,
you'll be showing a movie that you're not paying for.
Well, you're paying a little bit for it. You're paying a buck or two per ticket, not $8 per ticket.
Well, now, John Fithian, the president of the National Association of Theater Owners, who I just kind of have to mention what he says here, and he says it quite well, and he's said it at a number of events that I've attended, and he's quite well-spoken about the issue. He says, quote, "We think some of the studios are moving down a path of a bad business model. They risk losing two dimes to save one nickel." And he also kind of points out that when you are sending a digital signal into somebody's home, you're sending a near-perfect, almost master-like copy of it into their home. And how do you protect that from being pirated?
First of all, you can't protect anything from being pirated. As Peter Deckham said, people who are trying to fight piracy are building a bridge in the middle of the ocean. But I don't think that most people will pirate. When you buy an iTunes song, you're getting a perfect digital copy, but you're buying it. If anybody wants to go to the trouble of torrenting, you can find pretty much any movie you want to on the torrent sites in varying degrees of quality. And it's a pain in the ass to go and get them, and you have to decode them. And it's, you know, only geeks will do it if you make it easy for people to pay for it. Yes, he's right. But I think he's pursuing a shattered business model. Hello, ticket sales are declining.
Now, has Ryan Kavanaugh gotten back to you on this proposal?
No, everybody keeps asking me that. No, I doubt he's seen it. He's probably on vacation in Bali or something. I don't know. He's probably got better things to do. I'm not sure he's a real big IndieWire reader. Maybe he is. I don't know. But no one's reached out to me for that.
Well, thank you very much for reaching out to our audience and for joining us on today's episode. It's, as always, a fascinating conversation and one that unfortunately doesn't have an easy answer.
No, it really doesn't. Anyway, I'm a big fan of movies. Go see movies. That's my motto for 2011.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care. Thanks for letting me ramble.
No problem. Not
Bye.
At all.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Well, I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and to see a movie here on a matinee is $6.50, which I don't think anyone would say was an exorbitant price. And that's for any movie. I don't like the idea of different movies being different prices. I like variable pricing, but it should be across the board. You know, you want to go to a matinee, you want to go to a midnight movie, no matter which movie you pick, you get to pay this price. And I'll tell you, my nieces and nephews and college students and high school students are crazy about Inception, for example. That movie matters to them. They analyze it. They talk about it. They want to know what I think about it, what happened at the end. I mean, ticket sales are flat for this decade. Basically, it was smidgen down. Fine. You know, worldwide, they're growing. It's a $40 billion, $50 billion industry getting bigger worldwide. All these ideas are good ideas, but, you know, make good movies. I think that's what it boils down to.
I thought his ideas actually were spot on. I agreed with him 100%.
But they're all being done. Every single one of them is being done. People do release movies in theaters. You're not going to release The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is the Relativity movie of 2011. You're not going to put that on video on demand day and date. You're going to do small films. You're not going to do $30, $40, $50 million movies.
Yeah, I disagree. I think his idea is interesting.
Yeah, but the cost of Easy A, if it's made by a major studio, is going to be $50 million to get it to the theaters. It doesn't matter. You want to put a show on ABC, it's going to cost you tens of millions of dollars. There's no way to lower that entry level for the cost of a major motion picture or a major network TV show, drama, or sitcom. There just isn't.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if you want to reach 10 million people with your marketing, it costs money.
Yeah.
I mean, mind you, there are people doing it on the cheap and through guerrilla marketing and
indie films, indie labels,
and
indie studios.
Through what you're doing through social media, but it's a lot of work, and it doesn't happen overnight.
Is there any chance of theater owners saying, yes, you know, give us a movie that we can charge $4 for? I mean, imagine the confusion of having to say, all right, this movie's $4, but that movie's $9, and this movie's $6.50. That seems like a nightmare.
Well, they tried it in South America. There's a company called Zeta Pricing that had a piece of software and a program that allowed movie theaters to charge the way airlines would. So the closer you get to the movie, the more expensive it is, and for the different types of seats and the different showtimes. And it was so complicated and convoluted, as interesting as it was from an algorithmic point of view, I just thought, you know, commercially, I don't know how you do this when 50% of the people show up at the movie theater and decide what movie they're going to see. So you're asking a whole bunch of people to change their behavior, which is not done easily.
But I mean, any distributor can do a dollar day or a cheaper midnight movie, right? It just means they give a lower percentage to the studio, right?
Not necessarily. The studio might say, you do your dollar day, I still want my $5.
Isn't that against the law? Price fixing?
No, it's not price fixing. They're saying, if you want this product and you're going to sell this product, you will pay me for every unit you sell, you will pay me X. And so that's not against the law. The book companies, the publishers are doing that with Amazon. You want to sell the ebook for $9.99, fine, but I still want my $7. So if you sell it for $12.99, as we suggested, then you make your money. If you sell it for $9.99, then you only make $2. Anyway, Karen, I know that you have a client meeting in about half an hour, and we were on with Mr. Chubb a little bit longer than we anticipated, which is a good thing. Conversation was interesting. So why don't we skip ahead to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Then maybe afterwards, Michael, you and I can go over some of the music and television news stories on our own.
Guys, better get used to it.
Well, okay, then. First up, we have Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Or I know you guys like me to kind of do it in the voice. So Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
I love that.
Keeps turning off the lights on its Broadway performances. They've suffered repeated injuries to performers, canceled shows, shows cut off before their finales, visits from safety inspectors, and one actor in particular seriously injured and in the hospital. Apparently,
did you guys see that? Sorry.
Yes, I did, actually. There's some video of it. Christopher Tierney actually plummeted 20 to 30 feet into the basement of the theater, and I guess he had a skull fracture and cracked two or three vertebrae.
He's in pretty bad shape.
Yeah. Apparently he's lucky he lived.
Yeah.
The most expensive Broadway show in history is even more dangerous for the performers than it is for its investors. Karen, are these continual problems a big deal or a big whoop?
Clearly, I think this is a really big deal. I mean, I've never heard of anything like this. I mean, this is really amazing.
I think it's a big deal too, but honestly, I think it's adding to the aura of the show at this point. Oh my God, I've had old people in Alabama say, ooh, when they get it figured out, I want to see what they've done. I mean, it's like, it's the scary show they're killing people to put on, you know, they want to
see. I wouldn't be surprised if it never gets to the point where it's put on.
Oh, it will. It's grossing $1.5 million a week. It will open.
Viacom is getting out of the video game business by selling off its investment in Harmonix, the company behind the Rock Band franchise. But they don't exactly have their tails between their legs. Viacom made about $200 million on the sale. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to keep referring to my relatives. My nephew Craig had his college buddies over, and somebody said, do you want to play Rock Band? And someone else said, I haven't played Rock Band in ages. And they all said, who has? So I think it's a big whoop. You know, a major company tries to dive into, buy their way into an industry, and it didn't work out.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree. But I never thought about it. You're right. I mean, when was the last time I played Rock Band? Wow.
When was the first time I played Rock Band? Comedian Tracy Morgan had a kidney transplant in New York City and will recover for a few weeks before returning to his role on 30 Rock. Morgan was diagnosed with diabetes in 1996, but ignored his health issues until a scare on the set of 30 Rock. Now he's outspoken about diabetes and how to take care of it. Karen, is Morgan's new kidney a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for him and sort of a big whoop for the rest of us.
I say it's a big deal, and hopefully people will pay more attention to diabetes and how to deal with it, because it's a chronic and growing problem in the Black community.
Since MTV's biggest hit in a decade is Jersey Shore, it's no surprise they're working on a spinoff. Suki? The Situation? Suki. Nope. The first cast member to potentially get their own show is DJ Pauly D, a.k.a. Paul Del Vecchio. Pauly is indeed a DJ from Rhode Island. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in terms of surprise. It's their only hit, that and Teen Mom, so of course they're going to spin it off.
And it's Snooki, by the way, and she should have her own. She should have her own. I don't kind of barely know who Pauly D is. He's the one with the weird hair, right?
Yeah.
Never mind. Like, why am I asking you guys?
The latest movie in the Da Vinci Code series by Dan Brown is floundering a bit, perhaps because the novel's setting in Washington, D.C. and focus on Freemasons makes it very similar to the Nicolas Cage movie National Treasure. The screenwriter is out, and original author Dan Brown has been called in to see if he can pump some life into the script. The first two films were massive commercial hits, but critically derided, and it's not official yet as to whether Ron Howard will direct. Though it seems more likely Tom Hanks will be coaxed into starring again. Karen, is this delay in this major franchise a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, I think it's a big deal for those involved, and I really think it's a big whoop for the rest of us. It's not like we're sitting here, you know, tapping our fingers, waiting for the next one to come out.
Of course, Ron Howard directed the first two films. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It'll probably eventually get made, though. Having seen the second film drop off so much from the first, audiences probably don't care that much either.
In a year filled with documentaries that have admitted they were fake, like Joaquin Phoenix's I'm Still Here, or accused of being fake to one degree or another, like Catfish, artist Banksy has stood up to say his documentary film is all true. Banksy insists he's not clever enough to have faked all the evidence of the film's authenticity, which he says even a casual web search should uncover. It's important to him that people know the film is true because that's where it derives its power. So Michael, is Banksy's insistence that his film, Exit Through the Gift Shop, is true a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because I'm not even sure whether it's actually Banksy who gave the interview.
Good point, because of course he's a graffiti artist and nobody knows the identity of him.
I think it's a big whoop because I don't really think anyone cares.
It is funny that you have to like say, no, my documentary film is true. It's a funny world we live in.
MTV wants to cover music again, not on TV, but online. MTV is into its second season of $5 Cover, which looks at 13 local bands from the Seattle scene. That follows season one, which focused on Memphis. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
Clearly, I'm going to say it's a big whoop because I've never even heard of this show.
Michael?
Big whoop because it's online.
Hey!
Yes, but for MTV. MTV, if they cared, they would have it on their network.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi has been sentenced to jail for 6 years and banned from directing or producing movies for the next 20 years. Panahi was one of the leading figures urging on the Green Movement that rose up after fraudulent elections. Now, the man behind acclaimed movies like The White Balloon and The Circle is paying the price. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop in a sense because it's Iran, which is the closest to a democracy in the Middle East, but not really a democracy at all. This is what happens in countries where people don't have power.
Wow, that sounded really intelligent. I was just going to say, well, I think it's a big deal whenever anyone is sentenced to jail for 6 years.
Yeah, it's a shame, and it's nice to see the Hollywood community trying to shine a spotlight on his plight.
Is Steven Spielberg the new Warren Beatty? News reports say that Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is seeking advice from many sources about rebranding the Democrats, including Hollywood director Steven Spielberg. Spielberg's spokesperson put out a non-denial denial, as the Washington Post put it, in which they said Spielberg has devoted his career to making movies, not advising political figures. So they left the door open that he might be doing it as, you know, kind of a hobby. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
I can't say it's really either, but it really kind of sickens me in a way.
What?
That any political party needs like a movie director to help them rebrand themselves. I mean, that's sort of sad.
Michael?
I disagree. It's a big whoop because they do it all the time. But reaching out to people in advertising and other industries, creative people, to get feedback and input, I think is a good idea. What I found to be sad was the Washington Post story, which linked to this interactive thing where they posted a picture of Nancy Pelosi and says, hey, readers, send us a creative, you know, mashups. Put this photo into a Spielberg or Hollywood setting and send it back to us. You know, it was just such a pathetic little attempt to be interactive. And such a lame, pointless one.
Nothing's on there. They don't do what you tell them to do. You have to kind of leave it a lot broader. for them to play.
Steven Soderbergh quits. One of the more quirky filmmakers of the past two decades, Soderbergh has been insisting he wants to stop and focus on painting. Actor Matt Damon says it's true. Actually, he told Jeff Boucher. He's filming Contagion with Soderbergh right now and then the Liberace biopic in 2011. After those two films and maybe another one with George Clooney, Soderbergh will put down the film camera and pick up the paintbrush. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal when anytime a major figure in the industry, you know, changes careers like this. It's kind of like, what's his name, switching from art to movies. His name's blanking on me now. He did.
Julian Temple.
No, Julian Schnabel.
Schnabel, yeah, sorry.
Right, it happens all the time, but to really leave behind one career and try to find yourself in another one is always fascinating. It's hard to walk away from all that money.
Yeah, and I can tell you right now, he won't. This is a complete big whoop because it's never going to happen.
The Broadway musical Elf, based on the film starring Will Ferrell, has broken the box office record at the Al Hirschfeld for the third week. It grossed $1.5 million for the week ending on December 26th. All this despite dreadful reviews for the short-run holiday special. Those are Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark... Oh, sorry. Those are Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark type grosses. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Sadly, it's a big deal. It means we'll be seeing more junky, you know, throw-them-together holiday theater specials that are... You know, we're going to see The Christmas Story, the musical. We're going to see every stupid Christmas special turned into a Broadway show.
Well, whatever gets people to Broadway.
How about variable pricing? There's a place where we could use variable pricing.
Ooh, it's a callback. Oh! Like any good comedian brings back something. Oh, that's pretty good.
And on that one.
On that one, actually, Karen, I know you've got to run to a client meeting, which is why we moved Big Deal or Big Whoop up. Thank you very much. Certainly, we look forward to having you on future episodes when you have the time.
I'm happy to come back and be a guest again.
Don't go.
You know, now Michael's going to be stuck with me. He's going to get all the boring talk and all the bad jokes. You know.
Oh, for the love of God, please don't go.
I'll come back whenever you guys want me to.
So you're not like Larry King. You're not saying goodbye. You're saying so long.
I'll see you on down the road.
I'll see you at Spider-Man Turn Off the Dork.
I'll save you a seat.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Bye.
This is where we do an audio montage of Karen's greatest hits.
Wait a second. That would require me to do some work, which I don't
Never mind.
But what we can do is talk about...
Don't we end up the show here?
Actually, we were supposed to talk about some television and music news here, but we are running way long today, and my New Year's resolution is to get these podcasts under an hour, and so I'll move the television news to next week, and I can move the music news into Inside Baseball since our Inside Baseball topic wasn't all that interesting anyway. Of course, Inside Baseball is our weekly segment where we discuss the news stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. So let's see, what do we got? I guess we could start with Sony.
Tell me.
Sony launched their Music Unlimited digital music service. There's a lot of digital and music in that last sentence. But they have this new music service that is incredibly underwhelming.
Yes. First of all, it has Universal, Warner Music, EMI, and Sony, but it has a catalog of 6 million songs, which means about 500,000 albums, which is about 5 years worth of albums. I mean, it's just so lame.
Yeah. So, well, not only that, but it's only in the UK and Ireland. It's in two countries out of the entire world. So no matter what two countries it is, it's only in two countries.
Well, it's a soft launch and it costs $4 a month for the basic version.
€4 a month.
Well, isn't the euro about a dollar right now?
No, it's $1.31.
$1.31?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that good. So it's about $5.40 a month, something like that.
Something around, yeah.
Or you can do it on demand for about $13 a month. So it seems very similar to Pandora, but with a lot fewer songs.
Yes. And they're trying to tie it into their PlayStation 3 and Blu-ray players and Vio computers and televisions. And that's
so stupid. Nobody sits at their PlayStation 3 game console to listen to music.
And they're competing with Spotify.
Right.
Which is the service out of Sweden, a similar service out of Sweden that kind of is on-demand listening. Now, here's where I think you get these vertical integrated solutions that can cause problems, because Spotify is trying to make it into the United States. They have been unsuccessful thus far from reaching a deal with record labels. So now you have Sony, which owns not only the distribution method and platforms, be it televisions or radios or PlayStation 3s, but they own the content as well. So they can very easily turn to Spotify and say, sure, we'll play with you. Pay us $10 trillion.
Right. And so they're weakening both services.
Well, they're
not making it available in the U.S. and competing. Well, you want competition, but...
Right, but there is no competition here because Sony can just say, we opt out. That way people will have to come to us for the music.
Right. It's not a smart thing to do. You want to have your music available as widely as possible, but you don't want to give all your power to a competitor either. Everybody's freaked out that iTunes had so much power. They hate the idea that Amazon might have been the main source for books, and they want to make sure there are competitors out there. How else do they do it other than launching their own service or finding someone else to do something similar?
Well, in a sign that revenue in digital music streaming and digital music revenue is going up, Sound Exchange, which is this service that collects all the revenues from all of the streaming services and digital music platforms and then distributes it to rights holders, they released improved 2009 royalties, figures on them at least, and their estimates for 2010 are up.
Because people are listening to more music online and streaming it and doing all that all the time. Is that the point? Or are they just getting better at collecting the royalties that were already there?
Well, they're getting better at collecting the royalties that are already there. They said that their 2009 financials show $155.5 million has been distributed to artists and copyright holders from about $204 million collected from streaming services, including internet and satellite radio and cable TV and other music services, which is a 20% increase in collections and a 55% increase in the payments that they made over the previous year, which was 2008. Now, their big problem is the fact that they have a whole bunch of money and they're holding on to a whole bunch of money that they can't give out because the rights holders haven't shown up. So
it's about 20% of what they've collected, $42.9 million.
Yeah, I mean, $16 million in temporary administrative holds on funds and $25 million held from webcasters disputing the rates they've paid to Sound Exchange. It's a lot of money. And for 2010, it seems to be going up. Their total distributions will go up to $251.9 million, up 68% from 2009.
Well, you're drowning me in numbers.
Right. Well,
just keep it clear. I'm getting a little lost.
Okay. Bottom line is that people are making money online with their music. Part of their problem is that, at least Sound Exchange's problem, is that not all the musicians have signed up with them. So they have money for a particular song and they've got no place to send it. They don't know who to send it to.
How can they collect money for an artist if they don't have a deal with them?
Because the broadcaster or the streaming service pays them anyway.
Why would they do that?
Because that's what they're supposed to do, because everybody gets paid through Sound Exchange.
Oh, is it just sort of a collective thing that all the broadcasters use?
Yes, exactly. Okay. And new registrations received 10,953 new artists registered with Sound Exchange in 2010, and that's up 184% from 2009. So they seem to be doing well. But here's the interesting figure. The average annual payment to an artist, $2,800, up 80% from 2009.
Well, up 80% is good, and that's a nice supplement to your income, I guess.
Yeah, but you can't actually make a living that way.
Well, no, you certainly can't, but it's in its infancy, I assume. And that doesn't include things like YouTube video plays. It doesn't include a lot of things. It's not the only source of income. You've got publishing, you've got radio play, you've got everything. I mean, this doesn't include radio or anything like that, obviously.
I don't believe it does. Satellite radio, yes. Radio, no.
Right, yeah. So there's lots of revenue. You know, you get a check from here, a check from there, a check from everywhere. This is just one piece of the puzzle.
I don't get how that's up. The average annual payment is up 80%, but the royalty checks grow an average of 57%. Oh, I see. In 2009, they grew 57%, and in 2010, they grew 80%. So from 2008, it's up quite a bit.
Great. That's a big, good trend for the music industry.
Well, another good trend, at least for this podcast, is that of listener email. And this would usually be the part of the show where we read listener email. But I received so much listener email about our conversation last week over whether Santa Claus was real or not and whether Mickey Mouse was real or not, especially from parents who happen to be listening to the podcast while driving in the car with their children, that I don't think we can go over them all. But if you want to email us, you can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can find that contact information as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as all of our past episodes, as well as places to comment on us and places to subscribe. You can subscribe, by the way, to Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader. All of those links and all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. I'd like to thank our guest, Cotty Chubb. We'll place links to his story in our show notes, as well as links to his Twitter account. I'd like to also thank Karen Woodward for 85 episodes as our co-host. She can be found on her website, KarenWoodwardOnline.com, or on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is their username to look up. Michael Giltz, his Twitter username is @MichaelGiltz, and his website is MichaelGiltz.com. My Twitter username is @Sperling, and some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, and next year, play nice.